In this Friday edition, we share an interview with Melody Moore, spiritual woman for the Hoopah tribe, talks about how the current COVID-19 has changed her daily routine and what she is learning by this experience. We asked her for comments on any times in our history we experienced similar illnesses or pandemics and how we survived them.
Hey, Young. Thank you, Mr. Rosco, for inviting me to talk on the particular occasion of which I find myself stuck at home during international pandemic. And I am Melody George Moore, Hualiet, Kinjukutsuhtai, Tai Kamisting Nahuaye, descendant of the Huntanikiao. And so that's a piece of my passion work that I find myself doing often, which is saying prayers and ceremonies, conducting ceremonies for people who are participating in some of our older ceremonies, the deerskin dance, the jump dance, the flower dance, one brush dance once upon a time, and I'm currently doing some research on kick dance. So my day job, however, is for the Klamath Trinity Joint Unified School District. I teach English. I teach local history. I teach Hoopa language currently. That's the menu of things that I teach. So finding myself at home, one of the things that I wish to talk about first is how this is affecting me personally, I guess. Finding myself with a lot of time and a very different schedule than what I've been used to. So for myself, that has significantly impacted me because I have been used to a certain schedule for about 28 years, making sure that I get to school at a certain time by 8 o'clock, making sure that I have lesson plans prepared for students, being prepared to talk to. In some years, we had populations at the high school of up to 240 students, being able to talk to numbers of people in my day. And this outbreak of COVID-19 has put us into isolation in our homes, not for fear of catching the disease so much as being kind so that we don't give the disease to other people who in our populations may not be able to have such a good reaction to that disease. People who have respiratory illnesses, people who have impacted health, that population, we're protecting them. So I am fully participating in staying at home. I have a number of supplies in my pantry that I have been storing for and keep moving through. I'm able to stay home. I'm able to give things to people as needed. So I'm kind of pretty well off in terms of what subsistence-wise we're doing. I'm looking to plant a garden currently. So we're clearing off pieces of this property. We live in an old orchard and an old garden area that my great-grandparents tilled in years past. And so the ground is good. And probably has been waiting for me for a long time to do it.
Yeah.
Emotionally, spiritually, my situation is that I have been collecting books for years. I have a collection of rare books that are out of print. I have a collection of books that are for all ages. And so my personal library is very important to me at this time because I can still do research. I can look on the internet. I have enough resources to be online. So I'm pretty good right now, although I know that a lot of people are not. And this is the part that perhaps is the thing that I need to work on because it kind of breaks my heart that I am not allowed really at this point in time to share my resources beyond just the people that I have in my local neighborhood here. And I'm working on that, and we're waiting for direction from the school to figure out best how to go forward to continue to serve the population that may not have as many resources. So we'll talk about that more later, but I'm really good right now. And it took a little bit, though, to establish a new routine, and that was key. I read some articles that the New York Times was putting out, one in particular. There's a man that went to space, and he was out there for a year. And so being cloistered for a year without the opportunity to even go outside, because, you know, you have the vacuum of space out there, what did he do? And one of the things that he said that kept him emotionally and spiritually well was that he had a routine. He established a routine. And albeit it was a new routine that required certain things for him to do, like he was a scientist performing certain science experiments out in space, he was also working on himself as the experiment. How does long-term space travel affect the human body? And so he had to keep himself in shape. So he like exercised and he was on a particular diet. So keeping all those things in mind, I am appreciative of the humor on Facebook of people sharing out that they ate through all their snacks. And there's been a few days where I have been hungrier, I think more emotionally than physically, and I've overeaten on certain days, but I'm settled into a routine right now where I work out and our meals are at regular times and our bedtimes are at regular intervals, not staying up late. And that helps to have the routine. The packets from school help. And so going through those with my daughter and interspersing my own curriculum in there that I feel is important has been very helpful, because we live in a very blessed area where you just walk out your own front door and you can find plants and things and projects just waiting to happen. So I'm very well. And
you know, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
How about you?
Well, my routine hasn't changed much because we're one of the essential departments. So we have to keep the communications going. So sometimes in the past that has altered my schedule in that I had to go to these regular meetings every day and get updates. But this time around with COVID-19, it's all focused on one person and a smaller committee rather than having 30 or 20 departments meeting at one time. So they're trying to keep that number down and centralize everything. Well, how would that affect me is I didn't have to change my routine as much. What I am finding is I am doing more production, which is something I really enjoy doing. I mean, that's what my passion is, being able to do audio productions as opposed to managing a tribal department. This conversation I'm having with you is really a highlight in that I'm going to be able to take this recording and make a finished product out of it. Maybe we can make two products out of it. I don't know. But I've done that before with other interviews I've done. I've gotten sound bites, and especially when we're talking with Dr. Chase and Dr. Steak, I was able to pull out information related to the outbreak that we're going through right now. So it's really helpful. You just have to use your imagination. And
I agree.
Yeah, just
that's one of the things that is a survival technique, I think, is to use your imagination. So I'm glad to hear that you haven't been as impacted as I have been hearing some people have been impacted, and that's awesome. You guys also are pretty self-sustaining with a lot of your activities, though. I know you and Roby have a garden and animals, and you are pretty hale and healthy, and that's good. That's all contributing to your well-being. Your livelihood, your spiritual livelihood, is not contingent upon the electricity being on or being able to communicate with others in the outside world via the phone or the internet as much. Although your job currently, you have to download programs and what have you. If that went down, then you guys would be okay.
Well, yeah, Robi is getting into a position where she's trying to do holistic financial management as a consultant or a trainer or an instructor. And so that requires her to use the telephone and the network there. And right now, with this isolation thing and this shelter in place, she's finding her clients or her partners that she's part of her training is aren't as available. So they're off doing something. So it gets kind of complicated at times, especially when you start mixing in the other people's and in their lives and how they've changed. But the animals are constant. It's time for a walk. It's time to eat. It's time,
I have two cats, and the neighbor over here has a couple of dogs. My daughter lives like 50 feet from me, and she has dogs, and so yes, they are constant. So your first question that you had asked was, have we overcame other threatening situations and what can we learn from those? And I would say yes, we have overcame other threatening situations as a community. It depends on the century and the decade as to what those threatening situations were. And if you're referring to epidemics and pandemics, then yes. We have overcame threatening situations. We're still here. We're remnants of those that have survived and the prayers that they sent forward to us in this generation. And so with that in mind, just to be clear, the native population in California, from pre-contact times to around 1910, it's been estimated that the population dropped by 95%, but that was from a variety of things. And it's in the American period, goes from about 1848 till about 1910. There are two estimates. One is a higher estimate for epidemics, and one is a lower estimate for epidemics. And I wanted to make a point that Kroeber estimated that 81% of the native population during that time in California was wiped out by epidemics, whereas Cook estimated around 60% from epidemics during that time, depending on whose estimates that you're following, either 20% if you're following Kroeber or 40% of the rest of the population decline due to conflict and the competition for resources. So I tend to go with Cook's estimates because I don't want to let anybody off the hook for the genocide that was perpetrated upon natives in California, which time and time again does not make it into our history books in California or anywhere else in the United States. So it's really important that these population estimates be clarified along those lines because they could easily say, oh, a majority of the natives died because of epidemics. What size of that majority matters a lot because people need to be held accountable. The United States needs to be held accountable for those numbers. There's how I'll divide this is prehistory and then slide into diary accounts of things. And so prehistory, a lot of what we have survived would have been large-scale cataclysmic events that survive in stories. And in one case, the cataclysmic geologic event even is documented across the ocean with the resultant tsunami wave that happened. We live in a very geologically active area, and there was a significant 9-point-something earthquake that resulted in significant shifts in the coastline that at very low tides you can see off the coast of Washington and Oregon where former forests used to be. And stories of the natives all down the coast talk about a significant event. Locally here, we experienced such an event also. and it's in the story about our jump dance, the fall jump dance. There are two jump dances, and they are not necessarily that similar. There is a spring jump dance, which happens around the equinox, just like in the fall. The jump dance is timed to be happening in and around the fall equinox, the point in time when astronomically, when the day and the night are equal on Earth. The spin and the rotation around the sun create 2 days in a year when you have exactly the same amount of light as you do dark. And we have jump dances that are timed around those events. And the whole point being balance. The balance was disturbed one time, and the story goes, and as I know it was told, there's several versions of it, but as it was told to me, was a family that lived in the footprint of the current jump dance house that we build every 2 years. And that jump dance house had a man and a woman and a young son. And he was kind of, when he was born, he was sort of special, and he sang a lot, rocked a lot, and he was abnormally communicative. How about we say it that way? And so he had to be watched. He was very close with his mother, and she stayed by him and watched him. But there were occasions when, of course, she had to find the time to go and get water or to go do some things, and left him alone when he was older. She could leave him alone for periods of time. Well, this one time she had to go over to the river to gather some water for something she was doing. So she grabbed her basket, and as she was coming back up the hill towards the house, then she could hear him singing. And as she got closer and closer to the house, there was a cloud that had descended upon the house that she could still hear him singing from. But as she got closer to the house, then the cloud started to rise up. And then in that cloud, the voice was coming from the cloud, no longer from the house. And then it disappeared. She was frantic. And of course, she ran to the house and was looking in every nook and cranny for him. But he had disappeared. The father came back, and they looked and couldn't find where he was. They couldn't find a body. And so time passed, and they mourned him as though he were dead. And then in the version of the story that I was told, it was a short period of time later that the father needed to go hunting. And so he went up in the direction of Hostler Creek. And in that drainage area there was going along hunting and finding his way, because the light was not quite there. It would probably have been evening, early evening. And he could see something up in the distance, and it was glowing. And as he got closer, he could see that it was a person. And as he got closer, he could see that it was person resembling his son, although older. And he ran towards his son, going to put him into an embrace because he missed him. And the son held up his hand and said, "Stop, don't touch me. You have the scent of human on you." And in the story, the word that was used is mach, which means you stink of human scent, meaning that we have the stench of death about us, I guess. And so he stopped short, and the son had said, "I am only here for a short period of time, and I have something to tell you. There is something coming, something bad, and you need to help the village to prepare for this event, and this is what you need to do." And so at that point in time, he describes from start to finish, basically the jump dance from start to finish. And this is what you do in that time to prepare for this bad thing that's coming. And so at the end of this conversation, he has to leave, and the father's in tears, of course, and so he disappears. And then the father comes down from that place up the hill and ends up a mess for a little while. People are asking him, what's wrong? What's going on? And he has to explain what had happened and that his job now is to prepare for this thing that's going to come. So he begins to prepare. A lot of people are maybe skeptical, but there are those that are with him on this, and they prepare for this something that's coming. And then not long after that, after some of the most of the preparations have happened, then they wake up, and in that easterly direction that you could see through that drainage, there's in the morning a large black cloud that had appeared. And then the father thinks, this is the thing that he's talking about. And so they prepare to do the dance, and they begin. And as the story goes, each day that they say the prayers, each day that they sing the songs, each day that they do the stomping, that this cloud is diminished until after the 10th day, it's entirely gone. And so a lot of people have thought a lot about that, not just myself, but a lot of people think about that story and about what that cloud represents. And for some people in some years, that cloud has been maybe world wars, maybe pandemics like we're currently experiencing. Myself, because you can track a lot of these events also with a geologic event, I know that a lot of our high places look upon Mount Shasta, which is an active volcano, and the USGS.gov tracks the geologic activity of the volcanoes that are in the United States, and that particular volcano is on a 300 to 350 year cycle of erupting. And that would put it in the neighborhood of the time period when off the coast there was a Spanish galleon, 1746, that looked inland and saw an eruption of a volcano and noted it in the captain's log as they were sailing by, doing the rough estimate that this would have erupted about at that same time. This story that I was told about the jump dance is in the neighborhood of human time. There's historical stories, there's Kihanai stories, there's medicine stories. This one would have happened in a time period of humans. Although there are Kihanai visitations, they are not as the other stories are, where they are seem to be coming from an earlier time period. This one is more in the neighborhood of a historical story. And so a lot of our situations, the threatening situations that we would have had to have overcome in prehistory, would have been geologic events. Our geography, our mountains protect us, our land protected us because it's extremely hard to get here. We also have medicines, though, that would have taken care of individuals if they were sick. And there's a lot that has been studied about what nature of sickness would those people have had pre-contact. And I went to school straight out of high school to the University of California at Berkeley, and for a short period of time was majoring in anthropology. And one of my classes that I had at that time was speaking to something like this, that the types of diseases changed because the types of diets that we participate in now are way different than our ancestors. And so obviously the types of diseases and afflictions that we have nowadays are way different than what our ancestors would have had. And so our ancestors knew the concept of the sweat and knew the concept of steaming, putting herbs into a steam bath, and would have employed those, because we see that still remaining in our various ceremonies that we still participate in now, the brush dance and the flower dance. And those kinds of medicines that have been handed down and the nature of what they're curing is way different than what we're trying to cure now. So we did a lot of preventative types of medicines with the daily ritual of a sweat house, the men staying in the sweat house and the women staying in the big houses of each village. The men in the sweat house would have been doing a lot of preventative medicines. Now, with the division of labor between the two parties, the males and the males are the ones that tend to go out and about more and would be the ones that would have gone to go trade on the trails, to go to other places. And so the necessity of having a preventative would have been greater. Our bathing, the fact that we bathed regularly more than once during the day kept us really healthy and kept a lot of the undesired things away from our bodies, which is our first line of defense. And that has to do with our what we're being asked to do now in this pandemic is to wash our hands and to wash our hands for a set period of time. And what kinds of diseases? I can guess, but I remember one time that because of the types of diet and the amount of roughage that we had eaten and the types of things that we had eaten, our diseases were more of a what happens if you eat something bad kind of a thing than these poxes and coughing diseases that come later. Not to say that we didn't have seasonal colds, but the kinds of diseases that we have and the remedies that they would be employing, there's stories that survive about how to cure various kinds of vomits, how to cure various kinds of stomach upsets. So into the second part, so now we have history, and we're moving into the area of 1775, which would be the first recorded date of contact in the local area with Europeans, non-native peoples. Now, that doesn't say that other peoples hadn't visited. It's just that they didn't have a diary that survived. And so with the evidence of the diary, though, you can count on that other people had visited, because I think in this diary account, they talk of, that's in the book, The Four Ages of Churay by Robert Heiser and John Mills, published in 1991, that in that diary account of, there were two boats, the Santiago and the schooner, the Sonora, that made port at Trinidad in June of 1775 with the port, the home port on this coast being San Blas, which is south of Mazatlan in Mexico. That ship was on a mission to mapmake, and so they were on a reconnaissance mission to resupply at that time, and they made port at Trinidad. There are two people, Don Bruno Hesita and Don Juan Francisco de la Bodega y Cuadra, that are in charge of each of the ships, and they would have been making port all the way up the coast of California, although I didn't get to read the whole diary. I was only reading the part that where they touched base at Trinidad. During that time, there were three major epidemics because of the Spanish occupation that was happening in Southern California, in and amongst the mission. Those three major epidemics were, they were having to deal with, they say, respiratory in nature in this book that I'm using. And so I'm not saying that they brought that to Trinidad, but the possibility exists when you do your research about patient zero and where along the line did you interact with somebody who would be coughing and spreading things. You have to leave that possibility open that they possibly brought some diseases, although I can't find anything locally that would have said that at that time period. In 1775, also in Santa Clara, at the mission there, they were having problems in and amongst the population around there of coughing and a breakout of something that was respiratory in nature also. So from 1775, then you go to 1802 in California, there are some pneumonias and some diphtherias. Cholera is mentioned. And so all of these are killing parts off of our native population. And you can't rule it out that this did not affect us here locally because we have various ships that are still making port at Trinidad. And we have our population, which would have traded with Trinidad and coastal populations for seaweed, for abalone, for various things. And in return, we were bringing acorns and things that we had extra of for them. So there is one ship that I was researching called the Lelice Bird, L-E-L-I-C-E. Bird, B-Y-R-D, and its port of origin was Canton at the time. And it made port in Trinidad February of 1804. And at that time, I looked up in China if there was any pestilence or epidemics going along there. And yes, they were dealing with smallpox. And so possibly as early as 1804, smallpox is being introduced into the population in and around the local area, although there's nothing written about it. Now, in regards to our native medicines, there were a lot of people that did survive those early native epidemics in California, because of a number of different things, one of which I had mentioned in regards to social isolation and our geography. Our geography, our mountains protect us, our land protected us because it's extremely hard to get here. And when people move, they move diseases. And so a lot of our population was spared a lot of the diseases that were, I was mentioning earlier, that were present on the coast because people were moving around by boat from as far away as Spain and from China and other places. So our native medicines also plays a role in that. With we have the variety of herbs that's all around our reservation that we consistently use in steams, in a diary. There's no mentions of it other than they are having to deal with various diseases, but they make mention of trouble, quote, trouble from molesting women, end quote. And what they're usually talking about is venereal diseases of various kinds, which in the research of what kinds of epidemics and things that are going around with the collision of cultures, smallpox, you can say, was the disease that ravages the United States native population. But in turn, there was a disease, syphilis, that the sailors brought back to Europe, and syphilis ravaged the population of Europe in turn. And those diseases then mutate and come back to our shores again, but they're in a mutated form and affect us. Now, you don't necessarily die from some of these diseases, but it drags down your immune system to where you have opportunistic diseases, and you end up dying of something like pneumonia because that you had this other disease for a long time. So that's happening. 1806. I see mention of measles from Santa Barbara to San Francisco. And in a book that was published by the Smithsonian, and it's out of print, American Indians, Volume 8, has to do with California. There's an article that I am using, The Impact of Euro-American Exploration and Settlement by Edward Castillo. He uses a lot of population estimates from another man named Sherburne Cook. Estimate is that 45% of the native population declined during the Spanish period, which is 1775 locally to about 1820s, is due to introduced diseases and epidemics. So yes, we have had to deal with these threatening situations before. At San Francisco, I think they were talking about 1,600 natives died at that time in 1806 because of measles. 1827, there is a quote that I wanted to read from that article that states following. This is, again, Edward Castillo, and he says, "Even more devastating than military incursion were the white man's diseases. Venereal disease continued to be reported widespread as the general health conditions among natives continued to deteriorate. Other maladies followed, measles, pneumonia, diphtheria, and other respiratory diseases ravaged missionized tribes in a series of major epidemics until 1827. In 1833, smallpox first appeared to an alarming extent, along with scarlet fever, cholera, and tuberculosis. In the same year, the Wintun, Maidu, Miwok, and Yokut suffered an unknown disease called the Pandemic of 1833, in which as many as 4,500 Indians died, a total loss of about 10% for all tribes involved. A smallpox epidemic struck the Pomo, Wapo, and Wintun 5 years later, killing more than 2,000 before it was spent. In 1844, smallpox attacked the Miwok. A new epidemic of fever ravaged the Wintun 2 years later." It goes on to say that by the end of the Mexican occupation, the total native population had been reduced to about 100,000 persons in California. Now, if we're starting off, this is Sherburne Cook, with a population before white contact of 300,000, that's a significant impact. One-third, you're down to one-third of the population. Now, this is before the Americans. Now we're into an era which is more marked by violence than it is by these epidemics, although they're happening at the same time. And even though that these events are documented outside of the area, we practiced social isolation, mainly because of our geography. And it kept us from the main brunt of a lot of these epidemics. But because we traded with these tribes, we would have been impacted in some way, although there isn't a diary account that I can point to. We're being asked to do now in this pandemic is to wash our hands, and to wash our hands for a set period of time, because you have to allow the soap to disintegrate the hard shell of the virus, which is an acid, and the soap being a base, there's a chemical reaction that needs to happen where the little acid shell of the virus needs to be popped by the base of the soap. And so you have to do that at least for 20 seconds. Well, we didn't have watches like a long time ago, but we did have a similar method of where we would be steaming or in a sweat. And when we do each turn of a person singing, there is a term in Hupa called Mekuistu, which would be a way of saying singing, but it's you're measuring a set period of time. And because we did not have our watches to say, sing your song three times, would be in effect measuring out a dosage of time, if you will, to these herbs under the steam or in a sweat for a number of people to be singing, and you're measuring that out, or in a particular dance that we do. So when we're asked to sing a song to count out that time when you're doing the soap nowadays, it's just like we would have done back then with a modern twist, I guess. So I just wanted to point that out, that I think that's really cool that people are singing other songs other than they're singing native songs in response to some of what's going on today when they wash their hands. There is a story that's prior to the 1850s that's in the collected works of Edward Sapir. Dr. Victor Gola is the author of this. And he was mentioning in a footnote that there was one village that was impacted, and there are various names for this village, one of which was Huntet Mingwa, but it's near TCCC, where the footprint of the TCCC campus is now, that there was some sort of, and in one version of the story, it's pestilence that visited, in another, it's a geological event. Anyway, these various stories end up with that village being abandoned, I guess. So now we're into the 1850s, and there's a Gibbs diary of the Reddick McKee Treaty Party that said that in October of that year, that the Hoopas did not want to stay for a formal council because they had urgent need to go back to their villages due to a sickness that had been visiting. So there was some sort of sickness that would have been affecting them at that time, which sort of corroborates this village being impacted. So it gets a little more depressing, but then it gets better. I'll tell you this right now, it gets a little more depressing. So during the American period now, because we're past 1849, which of course the gold is discovered, and now we're a state in the 1851, 1850s, we're becoming a state. And so during this American period, it's estimated that 60% of the native population dies due to epidemics, with the other having to do with the various militia campaigns that affect us, the genocide that was perpetuated upon us in those decades. So locally, in the 1870s, we have a boarding school that starts, and you start to have that reports from inspectors for the day school from the BIA. They have diary accounts. That in the 1870s, the report was that we were healthy and hale. So in the 1870s, the population that they were looking at was had recovered from these epidemics. There was a report in 1881 by Robert A. Gardner, no diseases, even though elsewhere there's like we're getting hit hard in our native populations across the United States with smallpox and various tuberculosis and various kinds of diseases, measles. In the early 1900s, there is a report of an outbreak of cholera at the local boarding school here in Hoopa. Cholera is from open sewers, usually. It's remedied, but we're now at 1910, and in my local history classes, this usually results in a graph, a population graph that I have them draw, because this is the lowest point of population in California. In that census in 1910 was reported, and I use the number 15,000, although I see in other places they use 18,000. Whenever I can, I use the lower estimated number, because in what I've found is that people are trying to make the population seem greater than it is so that the impact shows less towards the argument of genocide. But 15,000, if you do the math, that would estimate that 95% of the native population in California had been wiped out at that point. So we are descendants of the 5% that remained in California. And so your ancestors, you climb up your family trees, and in the early 1900s, then you can start to document your own family stories that corroborate tuberculosis, pneumonias, death from measles, mumps, polio, and those kinds of diseases. So 1912 was the year that my grandmother was born, my dad's mother, AWOC, and there was a tuberculosis outbreak that was happening locally at the boarding school, which resulted in my great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, refusing to send her youngest child, whom we all know, AWOC Rudolf Soktisch, to the boarding school. He never attended formal schooling because she isolated him socially at home. She hid him from the truant officers that were going around to try to take kids to school at the time. But she had lost two others to this tuberculosis outbreak that also sickened my grandmother, my aunt AWOC, and my uncle, Ray AWOC, who throughout his life would always test positive to tuberculosis, which had him not be able to work one-on-one with a lot of kids at the school, because we had a rule at the time where you had to have a clean TB test. So various coughing diseases have visited us before and have ravaged us before. And what we have done since then is we have developed vaccines. And there's kind of like a double-edged sword with the vaccine, though, because it makes you survive, but it also kind of gives several generations later we've forgotten culturally how we've gotten to this point in time. And we think that maybe we are, that we are immune to such things, when in fact in the histories it doesn't point in that direction. So now, I said that I'd have a positive outlook. I said that it would be dark and that I would come to the end of that and tell you that 2010 census population of natives in California is 596,063. We are 1.6% of the population of California in 2010, which was 37,253,956. And that means that we have doubled the population estimates that were out there with, that were low, I would say. Sherburne Cook gave us a low estimate of pre-contact population of 300,000 in California before any white contact. I like to say that we were probably more populous than that. The way that they estimate that population is by a mathematical formula and the carrying capacity of the land. And so they like to estimate that population to be lower, 300,000. And I've seen and I've read documents where it's higher, but those papers are outliers. And they've estimated as high as 1 million people in California pre-contact. But even then, we're headed in the upward direction, and we're doing really good with our population right now in Native California. So I like to say also that we are in a sort of a baby boom, that the tribes in California have experienced a really good resurgence and are right now population-wise at a good point in time. So with all that said, yes, we have overcame other threatening situations before, both in prehistory and in the interactions with non-native populations that have come to California. Are you still there?
Yeah. I'm still here. The Sherburne F. Cook that you mentioned?
Yes.
That's Roby's grandfather.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
Yeah. And she's got his original books. She's got a collection of those.
Well, she and I are going to have to talk.
Oh, yeah.
And share.
Sure.
Wow. So I want to go back to, in my research of doing this, because I spent a couple days looking at a lot of this, because I was curious myself, how did we do in the past? Well, without a vaccine, we didn't do so good. That is a cumulative percentage, however, over from 1775 to 1910. That's a cumulative percentage for that 95%. And so in each generation, you would have had like baby booms, but then the epidemics, and then baby booms, and then the epidemics. And so it didn't all happen at one time. But I wanted to say that I found out something that was really positive, because we've all heard the stories about the United States government, the Army, not the government, but the Army, which sometimes acted by itself in its history, that distributed smallpox blankets to various groups to encourage these epidemics. And so that creates a distrust of government institutions, that creates a distrust of anybody who's non-native or not from here, I should say. And so historically, because I'm all about trauma-informed education, and a lot of the practices that I do now keep these things in mind, especially historical trauma, because then we inherit behaviors from our family trees that may not serve us so well in like this current epidemic or in future scenarios of something. And you always have to kind of reevaluate and reassess your tool bag and what your ancestors have given you. And so I wanted to share this story because I had never heard anything good anywhere about anybody trying to do anything about the smallpox, non-native. So there's a story that is when I was researching that ship from Canton, China, that came to make port in Trinidad in 1804. This is the wonder of Google. It brought up a smallpox vaccine that was being developed in the early 1800s by Spain, by the monarchy of Spain. And they were rushing the vaccination across the ocean. The cure was being rushed, but because they didn't have refrigeration, they didn't have petri dishes, and they didn't have like any of that available to them, how they did it was they got some live, I'll call them somewhat volunteers, although they described them as orphans, that willingly left the orphanages that they were at to be inoculated in turn during this trip across the ocean. And by the time they got to ports that they were going to help the native populations by inoculating them, that the live vaccine would be still viable. I had never, ever heard such a thing. I've read books, you know, about the serum that made its way to Nome, Alaska via dog sled, right? I remember that one, Balto, the story of Balto. But I hadn't ever heard anything about this, anybody trying to do anything good about smallpox. And I was like, whoa. And this is back in the 1800s. And so I think I'm going to do some more research about that, because that to me is a very interesting story, which is uplifting to me, because distrust that I speak of non-native institutions, non-native peoples, people off reservation, trying to help us in some way, shape, or form. There's a lot of people that have a lot of historical distrust for good reason. People trying to help that aren't from here, I guess. And so just to remind myself that there are good people out there that are doing good things. And so one of the things that I am doing, I'm looking on my feed constantly about people doing good for other people. And I see a lot of that happening. People are helping one another. People in New York City are at 7 o'clock each night applauding out their windows for the people who are getting off of their shifts in the hospital. That just brought tears to my eyes when I saw that, because that's just like, wow, that the millions of people in New York City are pausing each evening, each shift change, to give encouragement to the people who are on the front lines of this pandemic. So it kind of is inspiring me to try to do more here, although it's on a smaller level. I'm doing some things for people on a small level. It's inspiring me to do those things, though. There's a lot of things that are in our histories that get overlooked in the telling. I use a lot of oral history also in my local history class, and having listened to stories of various places and times and people from my family, and then even reading stories from other places, that has helped me out quite a bit. And so you had a question, how best can we rebuild our community as we start to see there just may be a new normal coming upon us again? So I'm reminded of the stories from the Southwest in which they talk about there being four worlds. The Hopis and the Diné peoples talk about there was a first world. Things went well, and then things started to go wrong. Then that world ended. There was a second world, and we're on the fourth world. And we're near the end where things are going wrong again. And then there will be a new world, but it will be a painful birth between the time of the fourth and the fifth world. And in their stories, what they talk about each time is that it always gets down to just a few, a group, a small group of people who remembered the teachings of the creator beings that made the place and gave us our medicines and gave us our belief systems and gave us our ways. And the people who stick closest to remembering those and singing the songs and still doing those ceremonies and still treating each other with goodness, those are usually the seed populations for the next world, not the greedy ones, not the ones who are forgetful of their ways. And so there's always time to remember the teachings. There's always time to go back to core beliefs, which I wouldn't even narrow it down to just Hoopa beliefs, but in each of the religions, they talk about treating each other with goodness and treating each other better than what we're seeing a lot of people treating each other like these days. And so how can we best rebuild our community is get back to the concept of a community. We're so distrustful of a lot of things nowadays for good reason. Does that make me not trust people? No, I always give people the opportunity to do good. And giving them that opportunity is what, you know, I've been taught. And then if they mess up, that's on them, not me. But I still give a lot of people that second chance, that opportunity to always do good. And that's been hard in a lot of times, in a lot of places with different people. That's difficult. But it's always about what you've been taught and keeping that to your heart and keeping that to how you treat each other rather than responding to the behavior that somebody else gave you. A thing that I would like to also talk about in terms of when I went to go visit the Menominee. I know I had said that I visited Hawaii and I never finished up the thought about Menominee. In Wisconsin, that tribe has a trauma-informed care system in place for its entire community. And it grew first from its education side on the reservation, and it moved outward from there to the tribe and to its UIHS branch that is in that area. And so all three entities work together using resources from Wisconsin Education Department, the tribal entities, and the UIHS entities, which have three different funding sources. They all work together in this trauma-informed care plan, which was amazing when I had gone back with a group from here in our education department. I was amazed walking from place to place, entity to entity, and they were all saying the same thing, and they were all so nice, and they were all so very positive. At first, we all talked about it and said, are they putting us on? Are they all, like, are we being, like, lied to in a big group kind of a way? Because we could not even imagine that an entire community was coming together in such a way. And they made sure that they told us that that they, in our descriptions of our community, it was very similar to a place that they had been in their past, maybe about 15 years ago. And they explained the entire journey that it took to get from not working together to having a shared vision and to be working together. It is not a pie in the sky idea to be doing that. And it is times like this, in this pandemic, where everybody's under stress and everybody is doing the best that they can, that we need to realize that these older ways of being and institutions that maybe have been harmful and hurtful to us, the way that they were organized in the past, we have an opportunity here to rewrite all of that and to make it more powerful and more inclusive and more community-oriented than it has ever been before. So there's also a little bit that was taught to me back in my tenure at Berkeley, game theory. If game theory is paring down what we do in life to just a few symbolic kinds of things so that we can study them better, the game continues longest amongst each other, you know, the people that are participating in game or life, when you do to the other person something that's positive and they return it, that continues, that game continues for a long, long, long time, the longest. And that's putting the concept that we want this game to continue for a long time, but not what can I get out of it, this interaction, the most, or how can I get the best, or how can I put myself first. That doesn't end up very well. It doesn't end up going for a long time, as does this other, where you put first the priority that you're wanting to continue the game. And so breaking it down that way, what we need to do is we need to rebuild the concept of doing for each other again. In the tribal arena, getting along with each other and making sure that all entities are best using the funding to do common goals, that is not pie in the sky. That is very doable based on what we saw from the Menominee Nation. And that's what this pandemic is bringing out amongst populations all over the globe, not just ours, but how can we help each other out? So one of the questions that you had asked also, my views, my dreams for the community in ways that pull us together as citizens and sharing a common life, which is kind of building on what we just talked about. So I traveled to Hawaii, and I traveled to Menominee, Wisconsin recently. And in both places, I've seen a couple of things that I've always wanted to try to put into place here. In Hawaii, what I saw was that the Native Hawaiians were experiencing a cultural renaissance, a cultural, linguistic, spiritual renaissance. And it was kicked off by their education system that they were employing. It started with desire to want to teach more language and culture to their students, to their children. And so they started out with schools in their garages, the Punana Leo schools. And they would start out with small groups, and in order to be a part of these groups, you as a parent had to put in time, and they had enough resources to where they could make a curriculum all day long, 1 hour at a time for each subject, for one expert at a time. So, like, for example, to keep it all in Hawaiian and to keep it all so that it didn't overburden the person, they had one teacher come in for an hour for math. The next would be 1 hour for history, but it was all in Hawaiian. And then the next would be all in Hawaiian, but it would be PE. Then they would have cooking and gardening also as a piece of this. And so that's the part that allowed them to take off culturally also, is because they were starting to do plantations of their plant that they grow, that they turn into poi. I forget the name of it right now, but it's their form of, like acorns would be to us. It is the poi that, you know, they always have to eat. And so that plant, they would go to do a piece of their day at the field to make sure that they have that. Now, in researching that also, the design around that kind of made me think about our forestry and how we are sort of underutilizing our acorn trees and our other foods that are available up in the hills. Our logging practices sometimes are at odds with our gathering and our, not so much the hunting, but the gathering definitely, but the footprint that we have impacted on our hillsides is starting to make it extraordinarily hard to continue to gather a variety of things that we would have needed, not just acorns. Although the moratorium that is on the acorn tree, the tan oak tree, is a good idea that was put into place years and years ago by a former tribal council during the heyday of the logging, then that moratorium still exists, and it's what allows us to continue to have our acorn trees now, even though from a logging perspective, it's not a very marketable tree. So thinking about that, how the Hawaiians have done these plantations for their native foods, you know, why can't we do that here? Why can't we begin to take better care of our hillsides using our burning techniques to a larger degree? Why not stop the logging since it's not necessarily a good thing happening right now? Put it aside for now. Maybe a future generation can benefit from it again because it has created a largesse for us during this current generation, those past logging practices. I appreciate that. But I also can't help but think, when we have these large old growth Douglas fir trees heading off north to some mill site in Oregon, whose AWOC belly button tree did we just log? Which ancestor had their babies implant their belly buttons in that ceremony that we usually do after the belly button has fallen off? It's a fir tree that you're supposed to be using. So grows the tree, grows the child. And that old growth Douglas fir could have been somebody's belly button tree from one of our ancestors. I can't help but think that. So my view, my dream for my community is that we research other more sustainable ways of making a living around here, more in keeping with some of our older ceremonial thoughts, and so that we can continue to enjoy in this new world that we're creating now for our grandchildren, so that they can continue to have acorns, so that they will continue to have basket materials of the quality or better that we have enjoyed ourselves. Salmon also. So question 5, What message would you send to your students as they experience these changes in their lives? Learning doesn't just quit after high school. Learning doesn't just quit after hours, after the school door closes. I think that this is a perfect opportunity for you to look at what you're interested in, research it, read about it, pursue it, put into practice something that you have created from some of this research. For example, a lot of people are going to be gardening at this time and they're researching about how to do that. Keep reading, keep documenting this time period in journal form. It may turn out to be pieces of advice that your grandchildren are going to use, just like I was reading the diary accounts earlier to document some of these events. So too, somebody might be reading your diary in the future to figure out how to survive something that you have already figured out. So that's the message that I would have for my students. Because if we're going to come out of this more empathetic, more, and that means empathy, there's sympathy and empathy. And a lot of people understand sympathy in times of need. I feel sorry for your pain, but we need to get to empathy, where I feel your pain, not just I feel sorry for your pain, but I feel the pain that you are experiencing, and I'm going to help you because it's registering in me as a physical pain too. So when we can get to that part, then we will work together like the prayer says. For a lot of these ceremonies that I do, there's a prayer for people to work together. And I will say that prayer now for everyone who's listening. Nhuong hlene sa'a naso delte. Everyone will work together in a good way for a good long time. That's a very good prayer. And so I try to learn something new every single day. And how I do that as an adult is I oftentimes read. Nobody's there to tell me or to teach the value of something that I just read or the spin that I should get from it. I have to be able to think on my own what to make of those things. And today I can count two things that I've learned. That story about the smallpox vaccination making its way across the ocean in live bodies of orphans, and that Sherburne Cook is related to Roby.
Two important facts. Yes. Well, I'd like to make a comment on what you had said about part of your dream about bringing back the acorns and focusing on making available more acorns. And you mentioned fire on the ground, how we've been doing this practice. And I've seen it many times around, especially around our geographical areas, our mountainsides, and people are doing it and doing it really well. But a missing element that was always here were the herds of elk and deer. And they too help shape the health of the soil that provided all of the food and the gathering materials. We used fire, but we used animals, or the animals were there for that purpose. What you need to have is large hoof prints that stomp down the earth and churn it. And you have to have animals that excrete more of their body content and value that would fertilize the soil as well and create all of these nutrients in the soil for all of the other creatures that are in life forms that are inside that dirt that makes it healthy. You have to hunt fewer animals, and we have fewer animals now than we had prior to the Europeans being here. And the higher populations, the more people we have, the less animals we have, game animals. So, and what you mentioned about the moratorium on the oak trees during the more peak times of timber harvesting by the council, and they made that moratorium. I'm thinking that a moratorium on hunting would also help. The forest manager, and when I mentioned bringing back elk herds, he said they would like to go in that direction, but in order to get issued a elk, they have to have a meadow for them to live on. And that's what needs to happen. Once we have a terrain that will support them, because that's what they need. So that's why we don't have any. Roby's a good person to talk about healthy soil and the need for healthy soil. And she's also a good person to talk about putting more animals on the ground. And she's, you know, that's how we've been refurbishing the acreages that we do have right now. Now she gets more of a grass harvest off of her 2 acres than anybody else in Hoopa. And most people get maybe two tons, maybe 3 tons. She gets 5 to 6 tons because she has healthier soil. And she has animals. And it's never tilled. We have perennial grasses. That's what native grasses are, is perennials.
Yes. So a couple of things. So I believe that the elk population is rebounding, just from personal experience and traveling north on 96 and encountering more. I have more encounters these days with larger herds. Recently, when we were traveling back, there was a slide that we stopped at. One of the gentlemen said, "Be careful of that elk herd." And we're like, yeah. We never, you know, didn't think about it too much. 2 turns down the road, sure enough, there was a large group. I would say upwards of 70 in that group.
Wow,
that crossed the road. Yes, wow. Now, the locals up there are probably having fits because they're probably eating a lot of roses and things that they may have planted around there, right? That's what they were doing, is they were in somebody's yard. Then they jetted on up the hill. But the healthier that you have of the soil, I agree, the more there is to eat year-round so that they don't have to come to somebody's yard to eat the roses. So Bald Hill used to be bald, and that would have been where we would have burned and had our local herd of nearby elk kept. Now, obviously, that's subdivided into people's properties and various lands, but there are other places nearby that wouldn't be that hard to refurbish, to call them from, because there's already a large herd at Redwood National Park that they have been studying vis-a-vis these fires that they're putting on the ground. And so, yeah, they prefer the burned areas to the non-burned areas. So one more thing, and then I have to go. In regards to soils and health of soils, we had an event at the school, fish fair event 4 years ago, and there was a soil conservationist that had been invited from the Redwood National Park, and he came there to share his 30-foot tubes of soil samples that he had gotten from the park at various places. A lot of it was dry and not so very interesting, but I was taking notes, and then we got to interact with the tubes. And I walked over to one of the tubes, and I looked at the top of it, near the top, because in the 30-foot tube of soil, there was not a lot to look at up until you got to maybe the last 10 inches of the tube, and then it started to change color, and then it got to the top where I could recognize leaf mold and various kinds of trees. I said, "Look at this. You got also the madrone leaf, and you got the can oak, the Nolithocarpus densiflora." And the guy looked at me and he said, "Yes, and interesting you should say that, because those two trees are what have changed that entire tube from what the sample is down towards the bottom, where you can't really grow anything, changed that volcanic soil, basically," more proof of my volcano erupting theory. "And you have near the top something that is producing foods for animals and for humans because of those two trees. Those two trees put large amounts of leaf litter and fruits that they grow on the trees, and that's the beginning of these other plants that grow underneath or nearby, which in the tree world, if you don't disturb the understory, you end up with miles and miles and miles of like mushrooms, medicinals that we use in a lot of our ceremonies. In the places that I gather on the reservation, the places that are in and around some of those trees that were left standing from that moratorium in previous councils, those areas have some of the best medicinals to gather for some of our ceremonies. So, yes, I think a lot about soil. I think a lot about plants and how it wouldn't take that much to get back on track with taking care of large tracts of land like we used to for our own food preservations and medicines and things that we have locally here. Someday that will happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's part of the dream.
All right. So,
okay.
But I think I pretty much said what I was going to say.
Very good. Thank you very much.
So stay safe. Wash your hands.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Every day I come home and that's the first thing we do is wash our hands.
In preparing for this, it made me go back in time to look how was this problem solved before. And this social isolation that we're doing now has been done before. It was provided for us by our land. It's also the reason why we are as intact as we are compared to a lot of other places that experienced genocide at a more extreme level than we have. I am so thankful for that, that the land has taken care of us, and it will continue to take care of us, but we also have to take care of it. So, that the world will return to its original intent that they had for us to be here. Thank you for asking me. That means a lot.